This podcast is brought to you by Sky Arts, proud broadcast sponsor of the Guardian Hay Festival, bringing you the book show at Hay every day at 7 p.m. on Sky Arts One HD with me, Mariella Frostrup. For details, visit sky.com/arts.
I'm Sarah Crown, and welcome to our final Haycast of 2010. Now, the second weekend of the festival is always packed with literary stars, and this time we've got some really big hitters, including Zadie Smith, Martin Amis, and Sue Townsend, who's here with me now. And she's in Hay to talk about the latest instalment in Adrian Mole's diaries called The Prostrate Years. And that's right, it's prostrate, isn't it? Because he has prostate cancer in this book.
He has prostate cancer. In fact, it irritates him even more than the illness. Everybody mispronounces it and calls it prostrate. But I do like metaphors, and it is a metaphor for the country, the state it was in when I was writing it.
The first diary entry is on, I think it's June the 2nd, 2007. Mm-hmm. And where has Adrian got to at this point?
Well, he's living in a converted pigsty.
Another metaphor.
Yeah, with his parents. So he's not in a good place, not in the American wanky sense, but it's one of those dismal, boggy kind of fields until he finally has a slight conversion to the countryside.
And people think of Adrian Mole, certainly when I was reading it when I was 10 or 12, reading the first one, The Secret Diaries, it's seen as comedy, it's called comedy, bookshops stock it as comedy, but at the heart of it, as we sort of got an impression when you were talking about it then, it's deeply, deeply sad stuff that we're talking about.
It is, yeah.
And in this book, his marriage is in trouble. He's, as we said, he's got prostate cancer.
It's never stopped raining. It's that rainy year when we literally did not have a summer. And the whole country had a kind of mini nervous breakdown. And we were hearing that climate was going to change. You know, we all got to be frightened of various illnesses now.
As well as charting his sort of personal voyage through the last 20, 25 years, you've also almost in a quiet way become the country's foremost political satirist. I think you've done everything from the Falklands and Gibraltar all the way right through to in this latest collection, Gordon Brown and the end of the New Labour project.
Yeah.
Did you set out with this intention at all?
Well, I think that's what I do. You know, I mean, you know, when I was just reading rather than writing professionally, you know, I did get hooked onto the satirists, the English satirists in particular. They were far braver than we are now. If you think that's what I am, I'd be very pleased to accept that. Thank you.
Not at all. The political situation in the country presumably has kept yielding all the way through new things to subject Adrian to, I suppose, in a way. And has that given you the storyline for these books?
Oh, every morning you listen to the radio, there's a story there. You know, I can't understand writers who say, I'm waiting, and then wait for 3 or 4 years. My problem is there are too many themes and things that are happening.
You're up at the Hay Festival to talk about your latest Adrian Mole book. Mm. Would Adrian ever come to a festival like this?
Oh, yeah. Although he can't afford it. He can't afford the train ticket or the hotel or... Although he's getting slightly more countrified, so perhaps he could sleep in a tent somewhere. But no, this Hay Festival is made for Adrian Mole. More than anything in his life, he does genuinely love books. You know, he was a bookseller, and they did sell antiquarian and second-hand and new books. So he's involved with them, and he actually loves that, the feel of them, the smell of them. Yeah, so he's very passionate about books. Mm.
And what about, just as a final question, the ending of the book? I don't want to give anything away to anyone who hasn't read it yet, but it's ambiguous. We don't really know what's going to happen with him next.
No.
Those of us who love Adrian, can we take some hope from it?
I think you should take hope from him, because he never gives up. He's open to new ideas. His big conversion to the countryside near the end of the book. For some reason, when I was writing it, I had tears in my eyes.
Well, I had tears in my eyes when I was reading it.
Because I wanted him to get close to what's important, and he finally has. We're so disconnected from each other, from our work. Some people never touch the soil. At conquer time, you know, you hear people, usually mothers, bringing their kids from school, put it down, it's filthy. I'm thinking, oh, please take one home and open it and show the kid that beautiful conquer. There's a big disconnection. we're at arm's length from what we do most of the time.
Sue Townsend, thank you so much for talking to us, and good luck in your event this afternoon.
All right, so I'm Kazuo Shiguro. I'm a novelist.
My name is Yotam Ottolenghi, in one of the books that absolutely changed my life.
Book that changed my life, which I think is a bit of a clunker of a question.
Is The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky.
I suppose a turning point for me was my mother giving me Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment when I was 16.
And I read it when I was 17 and naive and prone to influence.
I wasn't really interested in books. And I didn't think I could possibly read, you know, a book like that. You know, a long book, a Russian book, you know, serious book.
And it has all the passions and beauties and life-changing experiences that a 17-year-old wants to find in a book, and I found it there.
I was completely hooked.
I'm Zan Brooks, and I've come to the river at the north end of Hay on Wye to meet veteran parliamentarian and writer Roy Hattersley. Now, Roy's latest book, In Search of England, collates 4 decades' worth of journeys across the country exploring our national identity and what makes us who we are. So this location is significant because we're actually right on the border between England and Wales. It's quite literally journey's end. Roy, you're a son of the north, a child of the Pennines and the Peak District, and here we have a much more bucolic and gentle English landscape. Do you feel at home? Do you feel that this is your England too?
I don't feel at home in this landscape as I do in the Peak District. Oh, it's a beautiful place, but England is a beautiful country. One of the great charms of England is it has all sorts of different beauties. It's various. You can move over 50 miles, 100 miles, and find quite different landscape, quite different people in some ways, quite different dialects, quite different weather. That's part of England's beauty.
Reading the book, it struck me that at its heart, it's almost a passionate defence of patriotism, and the term patriotism has been almost co-opted by the right, and I guess you are reclaiming it in the name of socialism?
I actually do say in the introduction that I'm a patriot, but a different sort of patriot. I'm not a big England patriot, I'm a little England patriot, and the idea of putting these things together came to me at this moment almost of epiphany. I was giving a talk at Stratford, talking about Shakespeare. One of those bits was, "In peace there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness." And I thought, God almighty, here's the great, the authentic hero of English history, Henry V, before one of the great turning points in the war against the French, and he talked about modest stillness. And I thought, it's the England of modest stillness that I like, England that isn't pretentious, doesn't make a fuss about being English, is proud in a quiet sort of way.
That has odd echoes, too, of the famous John Major line about his England and about the long shadows on the cricket grounds and the warm beer and the dog lovers. Did that strike a chord with you?
Well, I like warm beer. I watch cricket. I used to play a long time ago, and I'm a dog lover. But I don't feel quite as sentimental as that. I think it is possible to be romantic without being sentimental. Mm. I admit unequivocally that I'm romantic about England. I feel English rather than British, but romance and sentiment aren't quite the same thing, and I hope I keep the right side of being mawkishness. John Major also had old ladies on bicycles.
Yes.
And, well, I have nothing against old ladies on bicycles, but they don't move me very much.
They barely move themselves.
very slowly, very slowly.
You're talking about the varied nature of the English landscape. I mean, it's the varied nature of the people, too, and it remains a tribal country in many ways. Presumably, in your travels, in the course of writing this book, there are places that you felt more affinity with than others. Where have you struggled to find a sense of belonging?
But strangely enough, the capital of England, London. I was originally going to call this book Tired of Life. Mm. Not because I was suicidal, even though it was at the time when John Reed had just become Home Secretary, but it wasn't because I was suicidal, it was because of the Dr. Johnson quotation, "He who is tired of London is tired of life." And I got tired of London about 3 days after I arrived in 1964 and remained that for 30 years. As soon as I knew I wasn't standing for the House again, my first decision was to get out of London.
Why? What's wrong with London?
Well, it's a city. It's crowded, it's busy. It's great. The great line from Wordsworth, which is about crossing Westminster Bridge in a different context, alone in the city, thousands of people, but you're on your own. And I am by nature a village man, and I'm a northerner, and that hustle and bustle of the tubes in London doesn't appeal to me. Certainly not living in the centre of London, ceremonial London, which is all to do with pomp and circumstance, and I'm not terribly good at pomp and circumstance. But the publisher and the people who managed my column for years said, well, you know, people buy books in London as well, and if the book is an attack on London, then we have problems. So there's a bit of London in that as well as everything else.
Where we're standing here, we're standing like on the border between England and Wales, and it's fitting in another way too, because your next book actually takes you over this border. You're doing a biography of David Lloyd George.
Lloyd George is the greatest of all Welshmen. He's certainly the best known Welshman, and Henry Tudor and Lloyd George are the two undisputably greatest Welshmen of all time.
Why?
Oh, because Lloyd George was the genuine radical of British politics. The book would cause some controversy because I'm not at all sure that he was right to become the man who won the war. That's the First World War. I think many of his spats with Kitchener were unsuccessful, and he should have imposed his will on Kitchener and changed the strategy before the war ended, because the Germans ran out of men before we ran out of men. But during his time at the Exchequer, from 1908 onwards, he was the genuine radical of British history. Not only did he introduce all the insurance schemes, health, pensions, unemployment, but he wanted to take a radical view of how the land should be managed and owned. He wanted to change society. He kept saying, well, of course, I'm not a socialist. I hate socialism. I hate organised labour. I hate the Labour Party. I'm a rival of the Labour Party. But he was more radical than any leader the Labour Party ever had, with a possible exception of Hugh Gaitskell, who never had the chance to put his policies into practice.
We've obviously just emerged from a general election in which your party has lost power and the Tories are back in. Does that in any way make you revise or calibrate your view of the England that we're living in at the moment?
No. It makes me revise or calibrate my view of all those Liberals who used to tell me what great radicals they were and how disappointed they were in the Labour Party's lack of progressive instinct. But it doesn't make me revise my view about England. England is a country which, in the great days of Parliament, the great Victorian heyday of Parliament, used to swing from party to party 5 years, 8 years, time after time. And that's happened now. It'll happen again in the next 5, 10, 15 years. That's how politics is. My only feeling about the general election is we needn't have lost. There was very clearly no great enthusiasm for the Tory party, but we failed to engender any real enthusiasm for us.
But you blame the current government more on the Lib Dems than the Conservatives?
I only blame the current government on some of the Lib Dems. I mean, Mr. Clegg, who is by instinct and upbringing and background and ideology a Tory, was not only entitled to join the Tories, it would have been wrong for him not to. That was where he morally should be. It's those Liberals, some of whom were once in the Labour Party, who spent the Labour Party years saying what was wrong with the Blair Labour Party and what was wrong with the Brown Labour Party. It wasn't sufficiently progressive. Now they're sitting behind a Tory government. It's those people who I've got very little time for.
Damning words there for Nick Clegg from Roy Hattersley. But Nick Clegg has also had a platform here at Hay. It was a last-minute booking by festival director Peter Florence, and he asked Philippe Sands QC to host the Sunday morning session with the Deputy Prime Minister.
If you want a perfectly pure outcome, you need a perfectly pure outcome of the election. That's not what we had. And to those who want purism, all I would say is then go out and campaign for purism, and then go out and campaign for a politics where only ever one party or one sect or one philosophy dominates to the exclusion of others. I have to tell you, I don't believe in that kind of politics. I believe in pluralism, I believe in diversity, I believe that it is no bad thing if you, and you're the boss, if you say to us politicians, none of you deserve an outright majority. I don't see what is wrong in saying, okay, in those circumstances, as happens in most democratic systems elsewhere in the world, politicians who, of course, have been campaigning against each other, hammer and tongs during a general election campaign, have to come together in order to provide the kind of government that is inevitable when you have an uncertain outcome.
We asked Philippe Sands what he thought of the event immediately afterwards.
One of the most striking aspects of the hour was the warmth from the audience. You're sitting up there, you don't know how people are going to react. As the event was being organised, there was some view from the organisers of the Hay Festival that in Wales in particular, he as the leader of the Lib Dems would not be well received. And I can tell you, sitting up there, it was pretty clear that there were strong and warm feelings towards him.
In terms of policy, did he say anything new? Was there anything that we can take from it, a direction in which he might be pushing the coalition?
I think he was very careful, and we all noticed this as I pressed him on some questions, not to preempt announcements that are coming. But on at least one issue, he said something very substantive, and that was in relation to the release of documents in the Chilcot inquiry. As presently constituted, the Chilcot inquiry cannot refer to any documents that have not been pre-approved for public release by the government. He made his view very clear that there would be a shift in the presumptions, and the presumption would now be for publication of all documents, and only those documents which could not be released to the public would be limited in terms of public access. So that was significant. The timing of that we don't know.
He was in a fairly expansive mood this morning and quite open to answering questions at reasonable length. Are we getting any more of a sense of where he sits on the political spectrum?
I asked him twice, "Are you a man of the left?" And on both occasions he said, "I am a liberal," which I took to be a no to the answer to the question that I was putting. So he's positioned himself in a particular place, and that will raise, for some people in the Liberal Democrats, for many people I suspect in the Liberal Democrats, concerns about where he will position himself when push comes to shove on the bright line issues that he and I talked about.
Well, Sarah, we've made it all the way to the end. I guess we should round things up a little bit and summarise how it's gone. How's it gone for you?
Well, this is the first festival where I've stayed for the duration of the week, and I was talking to Peter Florence, the festival director, this morning, and he said that if you stay for the week, you get much more of a sense of the kind of the ebb and flow of it, the currents and the themes that are emerging, and I've definitely found that. And definitely one thing that's interested me, which Charlotte mentioned on the podcast yesterday, are these different definitions of history, what history means to us, how it's taught, what we do with it, what we do about it. But in terms of individual events, I think the highlight for me has been still the event that I went to see on the second night I was here, which was Rorty Doyle. And when you come to a festival like this, you want to see something that changes your mind or opens your eyes. And the great thing about going to see Rorty Doyle was that I had a sort of a teenage prejudice against him from having seen the film The Commitments and just really not getting it.
You've just got a crush now, haven't you?
I have. He's my hey crush by miles. I think he's absolutely brilliant. I've read one of his books since I've been here, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors. It was great. I'm going to read the rest of them now. So what about you?
Well, I've been banging on about this Cambridge series all week. And I have to say, yesterday I went to see the psychologist Simon Baron Cohen talking about autism. And it was absolutely revelatory what studies of autism can say about what our humanity is, what empathy is. And he even had brain scans of what happens in a psychopath's mind when a piano lid is slammed down on the hands of a piano. And would you believe it lights up their pleasure centres? That is the creepiest thing I've heard all week.
One of the great things about Hay, I think, is that it's always amazing having this combination of people from all of the areas of public life, science, politics, literature. And it was particularly exciting this year after the election because we had a whole new swathe of people coming into power, and a lot of them have been here. And Peter Florence managed a really impressive roster of politicians, out of which came several very interesting news stories, probably the most interesting of which was the new Education Secretary, Michael Gove, suddenly appearing in the back of Niall Ferguson's event and inviting him to come and advise them on their education policy for secondary schools, which, depending on your political persuasion, is either brilliant news or absolutely terrifying.
Which, of course, is a cue for me to get in another one of my Cambridge talks. One of the tail-end events was Priyam Vada Gopal, who's a lecturer at Cambridge, who talked about how not to write the history of empire and gave a fantastic counterblast to all the stuff that Gove and Ferguson have been saying. Hopefully we'll be able to run some sort of extracts in it in the paper over the next couple of weeks.
And I guess, yeah, that's one of the great things about Hay is that you have that balance of views. So you can have one very strong thing at the beginning of the week saying one thing and a really good rebuttal at the end, and it just makes you think about things.
There's been some rather pleasing indignation, hasn't there? I was very pleased by Michael Mansfield, QC, who was wonderfully enraged about the Israeli attack on the aid flotilla to Gaza earlier in the week.
Yes, it felt very serious hearing him talk and very necessary and a real privilege to be here and listen to him talking about it. But is there anything that you think hasn't worked as well as you expected it to?
Well, there are a couple of disappointing no-shows, particularly Hilary Mantel and Philip Pullman.
Yeah, such a shame.
It's ill health, what can you do? And the thing is, festivals do have an ability to heal themselves, and when people are here, they find other things to go to. So all we can say is I hope they get better soon.
Yes, and then I think probably the The least successful event, I'd say, was the interview of Alain de Botton by Jerry Hall, which everyone I've spoken to who went to it found it completely bemusing. And although you might think on paper it sounds like an interesting combination, I don't think it quite came off on stage.
It's a combination that should remain in fantasy, isn't it?
We've also asked Tracy Sortwell to come back and give us her highlights. And you might remember her from earlier on this week. She's the festival goer who's come up for the duration of the festival and spent £500 on tickets. And we've been asking her to report on whether or not they've been value for money. So, Tracy, have you been to any real bargains this week, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think Joe Brand was my absolute bargain. £6. Mm. There was also Chris Evans. Now, OK, he was £10, but we also got value for money there because there was Anne Robinson interviewing him. So two for the price of one, you could say.
Tracy, you've spent £500,000 on these tickets. What is the real investment for you? Is it in the sound of people's voices or is it in the thoughts that you've heard?
It's been the whole Hay Festival experience, from the farm visit we went on to the autobiographical events, to the fiction, to the non-fiction, and to the comedians, even though there were different prices. And they were all here in one place. It would have cost me a fortune to go and see them individually.
Whose voice is it that you'll take home and treasure most?
Louis de Bernier. I'm going to go back home and read Captain Corelli's Mandolin again because I can read it with his voice there and not from all the film voices.
Okay, and Tracy, obviously the final question we want to ask you is, will you be coming back next year?
Absolutely. I've already booked.
I'm James Lovelock, an elderly scientist, and the last book that made me really laugh out loud was A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. Well, it's the character, Ignatius. Oh, I loved him. It really was grotesque, but lovable at the same time.
Zan Brooks here again, back within the flowery borders of the Hay Festival, and rather tenuously, I'm sitting outside the Ritzy, the most cinematically themed place on the site. I'm here because I'm joined by Charlie Higson. Now, Charlie was the frontman of the Higsons band during the 1980s, and has been a writer and performer on The Far Show, before forging a new career as the author of the Young Bond books, and more recently, The Enemy, a story of a group of children battling the adult sufferers of a zombie-like plague in a post-apocalyptic London. Charlie, first of all, I think we need to identify The Enemy. I want to call it a zombie novel, but I'm aware that zombieism is a very particular diagnosis and people get very excised.
Well, yeah, I mean, there seems a lot of rules about zombies, but there seems to be a lot of broken rules about zombies. I saw Zombieland the other day, thought I'd better keep up with the latest stuff, and actually they're not technically zombies because they're not dead and come back to life. They're just diseased, which is what the guys in my book are, so I think I'm allowed to actually call them zombies now. I was a bit careful when I started, in case people said, well, they're not really zombies because they're not dead.
Well, Simon Pegg, I know, gets very agitated at the misuse of zombieism.
Yes, well, actually, interestingly, though, George Romero, who created the modern craze for cannibal zombies with Night of the Living Dead and Day of the Dead, apparently, and I need to go back and check, but he says that he never actually calls them zombies at all in those films. Mm. So as other people who call them zombies. So, you know, you can get hot under the collar about it, but, you know, it really in the end doesn't matter.
It's except, a broad church.
Yes, except there is, because the central argument is whether they should be fast or slow.
Yes.
Zombies. And I'm a traditionalist on that. I do believe they should be slow. I find them scary when they go slowly.
Yeah, why's that?
If they're just running quickly, they're just nutters, really, aren't they? I mean, they're not, they haven't got any of their special zombie attributes.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because zombies seem to be one of the most politically freighted of all the horror genre monsters, in that they're usually seen as metaphors for the modern age and for sort of shambling consumer culture.
Yes.
And yet here, the added layer is that they are adults. So,
yes.
So what's inherently frightening about
the
grown-ups?
Zombies. Well, grown-ups are inherently frightening. I mean, my 11-year-old had a nightmare last night where, you know, it was just, he was being chased by a man who was trying to kill him. And that seems to be, you know, that's a standard nightmare for kids. And, you know, when you're a father, you chase your kids around as a big scary monster and they run screaming and hiding. I mean, if you wanted to draw some serious points from my novels about children being chased by zombie adults who are trying to kill them and eat them, then it goes back to the idea of, to an adult, actually, the younger generation are the enemy, and to the younger generation, us adults are the enemy.
So you writing this book is the equivalent of you chasing your son around as a monster?
Totally, yes. Yes, and you do have that thing of, oh, am I being too scary?
Right, yeah.
I better pull back a bit. And they say, no, be more scary. And then they start crying. And say, stop it, stop it. And then they start laughing and say, no, be more scary. So when you're writing a book, you're kind of doing that.
Adjusting all the time.
Yeah, because when I started it, I didn't know how scary you could make a book for kids, how far you could go. So I read it to he was 10 years old at the time, as a bedtime story. And so I get to the first scary bit, I think, this is going to really freak him out. And as I'd read it to him, and he said, what do you think? He said, yeah, that was good. Yeah, I like that. I think, okay, I'm going to have to push this a bit more. So the next really, I make the next bit even more gory and terrifying or whatever. And again, I like that. Yeah, it was good when his head exploded. And so I just kept pushing it and pushing it and pushing it until one night, about 4 a.m, he came bursting into our bedroom, absolute floods of tears. He had this terrible, terrible nightmare. And I thought, yes! I finally got the little bastard.
I was reading that there's a different version of this going out in the States. There's like a Disney have bought it and they're publishing a cleaned up version.
Well, it's interesting. In the States, they've made everyone 2 years older.
Right.
So in the States, it's everyone over the age of 16 has been hit by this disease. And simultaneously, they have taken out some of the more explicit, gory bits.
Right.
You know, just the odd line.
So it's about
10
pages long, this book.
No. It's just the odd line here and there. I mean, I fought with them over it, but in the end, there's this. They're very scared over there of if you get any complaints from parents, then, it can get banned by the schools, it won't get stopped by the libraries, and it's a very powerful kind of cabal over there of librarians and school teachers and shopkeepers, and if you get on the wrong side of them. So they're a little bit nervous. But I've just been over there doing a book tour and going around these schools, and I've been making sure I read out the really, really nasty bits that have been cut from England, and they love it, of course. And I made sure that my editor was there, and I said, look, kids love this kind of stuff. But they're scared about the parents complaining. But I think the hope is that if there's no complaints in the first book, that we can then not worry about it too much on the other ones.
And the enemy is the first of a series. Are you going to move the action out of London, maybe even here to Hay?
Well, I mean,
how would that be?
Well, again, you see, it comes back to the allegorical nature of zombie movies. But yes, it is easy to look around and think that all these people here are kind of literature zombies.
Yeah. Well, you could also have the stars. You could have the monster Martin Amis and
yes.
The zombie Chris Evans.
Exactly.
And they'd still be having their events in the big tent.
A zombie Martin Amis goes berserk at the Hay Festival and starts attacking his audience.
And what about you? Because I was reading, you said somewhere that you described yourself as a classic shy person who's unleashed by alcohol. is that the inner zombie coming out then?
I think I'm probably more of a zombie when I'm not on the alcohol. So I think, yes, alcohol releases my inner human being.
Right, okay.
Where'd you get that quote from?
you dig around,
yes.
Find it.
You've gone further than Wikipedia, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of people have been asking me recently how my new book on American Indians is coming on.
Oh,
Native
yeah.
Americans, which apparently someone put on Wikipedia for a while. I've checked, it's not there anymore, but people kept asking me.
People can cause havoc with you by doing
things
like
that.
Well,
I quite enjoy it, really. Yeah. I think I might put some of my own on there.
Well, that's it for today and for this year's Haycast. For anyone who might be worrying about having withdrawal symptoms, we'll have a special on Monday for you with the New Yorker editor David Remnick, who of course is Obama's biographer, but who we will also ask about the New Yorker list of 20 best authors under 40, which will be published on Monday.
But before we go, I just wanted to give regular listeners an update about something that happened on the podcast earlier this week. You may remember that we took a trip around Hay on Wye itself with Rick Jacoski, who's a rare books dealer, and he found in the poetry bookshop a collection of W.H. Auden, which was inscribed by Auden. It was beautiful and really amazing, and the poetry bookshop were asking for £6,000 for it, which is a very scary amount of money. But they dropped it down to £4,000, and he was tempted, but he didn't bite. He left. He walked away without it. But I got an email from him this morning saying he changed his mind, he went back and bought it, and I was very pleased.
Wow, what a nice piece of news to end on.
And we should thank the team who've been working so hard with us here this week: Charlotte Higgins, Natalie Hanman, Alison Flood, Andrew Dixon, and Zan Brooks.
And of course, John Harris, Alok Jar, Julia Eccleshare, Richard Lee, and David Shariat Madari. Not forgetting our doughty producers, Francesca Panetta, Lucy Greenwell, and Scott Corley. We'll be back on Friday with our usual books podcast.
But to play us out, here's Tiamani Diabate and his band who performed here this weekend.
Amadi! Amadi! Tirame, tirame, sabe, 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 sabe,
very much. That was the last song.